The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
We can sit.
A lot of people get it wrong.
The first order of business, and I'll forget to say this unless I start with it, is please turn your cell phones off. I'm Bob Huber, features editor at Philadelphia Magazine, and on behalf of the magazine and the Free Library, welcome to Jim Crace.
Hi.
The Pest House, Jim Crace's ninth work of fiction, has been my introduction to his work, so I had a highly interesting and also somewhat depressing weekend reading it, which is actually a compliment. We'll get to all that. He's also published Continent, which is a book of short stories, and the novels The Gift of Stones, Arcadia, Signals of Distress, Quarantine, Being Dead, another book of short stories called The Devil's Larder, and the novel Genesis. Jim has won quite a number of awards. Here's an abbreviated list. The Whitbread Award for Continent, his book of short stories. The Whitbread Prize for Best Novel in 1997 for Quarantine. A National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction and a Book Review Best Book Selection, both in 2001 for Being Dead, which was also shortlisted for the Booker Prize. He has honorary doctorates from the University of Central England and University of Birmingham. He's done some interesting and unusual things in his career prior to being a novelist. He was with Sudanese Educational Television in Khartoum as a volunteer producer and writer, 1968-69. He taught English in a secondary school in Botswana, 1969-70. He was a freelance radio and feature journalist, 1970 until 86, when he became a full-time novelist. I'm very jealous to say that, full-time novelist.
Where do you get all this stuff from?
Is any of it true?
It's true, but it's so remotely true that I've forgotten most of it myself.
Good, I'm glad I dug it up. You define yourself as a libertarian socialist, is that true?
Yep.
You're an atheist. You're a member of a campaign for nuclear disarmament. That has to be true.
Yep.
Okay. You're married with two children, and you live in Birmingham, England.
That's correct.
Good. Okay. Let's turn to his work, the nature of his work. Although his books are often remarkable for their unique settings, Continent takes place on an imaginary continent, while The Gift of Stones is set in a prehistoric era. His book's scenery becomes subordinate to Crace's intense, though seemingly simple and natural, examination of communal behavior. "I'm not interested in truths or in drawing an accurate picture of the real world," he told the New York Times Book Review. "I'm interested in exploring the verities of the human condition. I believe that in some respects, if you hit the nail of storytelling right on the head, then you can come up with lies which are more powerful than any truth." Now, this has taken Jim Crace into some pretty wild places. His first book, Continent, portrays an invented and unnamed continent modeled after the Third World. A collection of seven loosely connected stories, the work contains vignettes that demonstrate how development impinges on old world ways, often exploiting the continent's natives. Nevertheless, Crace once said that the work was never meant to be a polemic or even to represent his own opinions. "With Continent, I wasn't writing about what I knew, political views that I'd already formed about the relationship between the Western world and the Third World, or between the new ways of mankind and the old, he explained. I was writing about what I was interested in and what I still wanted to debate and discover. So that book poses questions rather than answers them. I find that a much more interesting way of approaching narrative than writing political tracts. Robert Olin Butler described the essence of continent in the New York Times Book Review, quote, "Tradition and progress, superstition and rationalism, the primal and the mercantile struggle for the souls of men." Okay, what does that mean? Well, in one story, as an example, a city-educated young man returns to his small village and contemplates how to carry on his father's business of selling milk with supposed magical properties. The son decides to continue marketing the milk as magical, determining that preying on the villager's superstitious nature can be quite profitable. In another story, electricity is introduced to a town by way of a ceiling fan in a local establishment. The fan packs so much power, though, that it knocks bystanders against walls while the urbanized installer of the appliance stands safely in the calm of the fan directly beneath. Calling the book brilliant, provocative, and delightful, Butler, the critic, wrote, "One of the basic tasks of fiction is to strip down and rearrange experience in order to distance the reader from habitual reactions to surface reality and thereby, paradoxically, draw him closer to a deeper reality." Mr. Crace does this splendidly. Here's what another critic said about Crace's first novel, The Gift of Stones. Quote, "One of Crace's virtues is to make a deep imprint with light steps. The implications of his novel are complex, but they grow out of simplicity." And Jim Crace's own words on writing novels, writing fiction. "One of the key pieces of advice which colors the way I write is something I read many years ago from a Chinese poet called Wei Tai. He said that poetry presents the thing in order to convey the feeling. If a writer wishes to set heaven and earth in motion and call up the spirits, then he should be precise about the thing and reticent about the feeling or the emotion. In other words, the writer ought to describe the coffin and not the grief. This has been advice that I've applied to fiction. I don't want to define for the reader the heights or depths of emotion that he or she should feel, but to provide the raw materials that will elicit that response independently from the reader. That's one of my narrative methods." I include these quotes because I think they bear in on, and they're about his early work, but they bear in on his latest work, Pest House. Now, Pest House is a novel that takes place in an America of the future. Some unnamed cataclysm has destroyed all the technology and the government. The citizens are illiterate, and the land they live on is poisoned by toxins. That was my weekend. In a reversal of the westward movement of the 19th century, these Americans are heading east, hoping to catch a ship back to Europe, which has been described as the Promised Land. The book follows the journey of Franklin Lopez and Margaret, two survivors who are thrown together on the journey east. And I can tell you, after spending that weekend with them, that it's a pretty rugged journey where their futures and that of America itself, such as it is, is always hanging in the balance. Why don't you read a little bit from Pest House? You were going to read some of the introduction, I think, okay. The first couple pages.
Right. Does this work? Yes. Well, I'm not going to use it then.
Good.
I'm going to stand up here. Does this work? Yeah. This is the wrong book.
One of the reasons we're having Jim read, we often don't do that at these kinds of events, but it's got such a particular style, and to get a little flavor of what he's up to, we thought it was a good idea, so...
Yeah, this is going to be a very, very short reading. It's going to take about a minute and a half, so you can all relax. I'm sure you've been to readings when the author reads for 40 minutes and forgets that there's an audience. But the idea is just to give you a sense of the kind of prose that I write. I write in the oral tradition, and that is that all of my printed All of my printed sentences, nevertheless, are written as if they should be read out loud. And I pay a lot of attention to the cadence of the sentences and the timpani of the sentences, as it were. And because the English language is tends to follow iambic form, my prose does the same. A critic in England, a very smart critic called Adam Mars Jones, said to read a paragraph of Jim Crace's prose is to invite a migraine. So I advise anybody that has migraine problems to leave the room straight away. But I have aspirins in my case if anyone does get caught. I'll just say something else about this. Some while back, a Cambridge professor of English and a Japanese mathematician got a grant to do research on a mathematical formula for the difference between poetry and prose. And they really did come up with a mathematical formula. I didn't understand it at all, but it was measuring stresses, and it was measuring beats and all kinds of stuff that you find within sentences and within individual words. And then to test their theory, at the end of having come up with this this mathematical formula for prose and another one for poetry, they decided to look at a work of poetry, a work of prose which was pretending to be a poem, and to see how that measured up. And that was T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. And then they needed to test the opposite of that, and they needed what they considered to be a work of poetry that was pretending to be prose. And for that, they chose my earlier novel, Quarantine. So they then applied it to the computer and did the test, you know, in the way that only academics can. And lo and behold, it turns out that that T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets is written in prose, even though it's pretending to be a poem. And my book, Quarantine, is written in poetry, even though it's pretending to be prose. So when they explained this to me, I said, well, yeah, it's pretty interesting. I wasn't especially surprised. I said, but, you know, what would be interesting would be, what if you took everyday, ordinary speech, just the way people talk to each other every day in the street? You know, how would that come out on your mathematical theory? And they said, well, you'd be amazed. And I thought, oh, no, I wouldn't. You'd be amazed. We did that. We took 1,000 different examples of just court speech, and we put it through our mathematical test. And in every instant but one, so 999 times out of 1,000, spoken language came out as poetry. And I think this is something, you know, as we speak, as you listen to me speaking now, or you listen to yourself speaking to friends later in the evening, we are not remiss about these things. We are concerned with the rhythm of language as we speak. We do think about the percussion of language as we speak. It's only written prose that doesn't pay attention to that, and T.S. Eliot. So the opening, very quick opening section here. I tend to visit dark places in my books because my books are a hunt for optimism. And optimism which is found in light places is really not worth having. It's not very firm or hard, is it? So I always go to hard places to find my optimism, because then the optimism you find is worth having, I think. And this book starts with a catastrophe in a small American town several hundred years in the future. But this catastrophe can happen. This sort of thing can happen. And the events I'm going to describe here, in which a lake explodes and releases all its gases, happened in 1986, the last time, in Lake Nyasa in Cameroons. And 3,000 people died overnight. 20,000 cattle died overnight. Every living creature died overnight, where this cloud of gases released from the lake just travelled over their village. Not a scratch, not a bruise, but just a lot of death. Everybody died at night. Most were sleeping at the time, the lucky ones, who were too tired or drunk or deaf or wrapped too tightly in their spreads to hear the hillside, destabilized by rain, collapse and slip beneath the waters of the lake. So, these sleepers, 600 or 700 at a guess, no one ever came to count or claim the dead, breathed their last in passive company, unwarned and unexpectedly, without any fear, their final moments dormant in America. But there are always some awake in the small times of the morning. The lovemakers, for instance, the night workers, the ones with stone-hard beds or aching backs, the ones with nagging consciences or bladders, the sick, and animals, of course. The first of that community to die were the horses and the mules, which the travellers had picketed and blanketed against the cold, out in the tetherings between the houses and the lake, and beyond the human safety of stockades. They must have heard the landslide. They were so close and unprotected, though it was not especially bulky, not bulky enough probably to cause much damage on its own. In the time that it would take to draw a breath and yawn, there was a muted, stony splash, accompanied by a barometric pop, a lesser set of sounds than thunder, but low and devious nevertheless, and worrying. For how could anyone not know by now how mischievous the world could be? The older horses, connoisseurs of one-night stands when everything was devious and worrying, were too weary after yet another day of heading dawnways, shifting carts, freight and passengers, to do much more than tie their ears, to tick their ears and flare their nostrils. Even when, a moment later, the displaced waters of the lake produced a sloshing set of boisterous waves where there had not been any waves before, the full-growns would not raise their heads. But the younger horses and the ever-childish mules tugged against their ropes, and one or two even broke free, but hadn't the foresight to seek high ground in the brief time that remained. What happened next was almost silent. The landslip had hit the deepest side of the lake and therefore took some moments to reach the bottom, 10 man-heights from the surface. And then it took some moments more for the avalanche of stone, earth, swarf, and ancient buried scrap to show how heavy it was and squeeze the life out of the gas-rich sediments, the volatile silt and compacted weeds, the soda pockets, which had settled on the bed through centuries and were now ready, eager almost, for this catalyst. Shaken up and shaken out in one great flatulence, the water fizzed and belched until all the gases were discharged to form a heavy, deadly, surface-hugging cloud, not as high as the pines, but higher certainly than animals. There wasn't any wind that night to thin the suffocating vapours, and there was no longer any rain to wash the poison from the air. But there was gravity to direct them down, beyond the rapids and cascades, along the valley, past the tetherings, past the secret wooden bridge, past the metal fields, past the stone footings of the one-time shoe factory and tanning works, to seep between the palings of the pine stockades and settle on the town at the river's crossing point, where almost everyone was sleeping and dreaming of the ruined, rusty way ahead and all the paradise beyond.
Thank you. It takes a while to get to the optimism.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to turn this over to your questions shortly, but I'll start with a few. I'd like to learn more about the genesis of the story, the Pest House. You mentioned in your remarks that there was a disaster in '86 that maybe triggered the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
But it seemed to me as I was reading, I mean, I was guessing you had an apocalypse on your mind in some fashion and then fashioned a story out of that sort of grand or big idea. That may be wrong. Talk about the genesis, if you would, of it.
Well, anything that anyone says, any writer says about the genesis of a book is 70% not to be believed. Because if a book is working well, it has an agenda of its own. You know, narrative is an ancient thing. It's been with us for thousands of years.
Right.
it confers upon us an advantage. Otherwise, it would have died out. That's just plain Darwinism. Therefore, it knows a thing or two. And if you're a wise writer, I think, you embark on a book with a certain set of agendas, things that occasion the book. But you listen to what the narrative wants you to do with it. And so very often, you know, I can give you a spiel about what started this book, but it might not quite add up to the finished work.
Right.
Because the narrative abandons you. That's an exciting thing about fiction. And it asks you to go in new directions. However, I'm not trying to get out of the question. But there are several sets of things that occasioned this book. And they've been spread over many years. And the very first one was as long ago as 20 years ago, when my wife and I started visiting a group of islands off the west coast of England called the Scilly Isles, the Isles of Scilly. And there's 140 islands there, of which five are inhabited. And we go there all the time. We spend every summer there. We've just come back. We're just about to go again. Amongst one of these islands, there's an island called St. Helens. And on St. Helens, an uninhabited island, is an old tumbled-down, cobbled-up brick building which hasn't been lived in for several hundred years. That was established in the 1760s as what is known as a quarantine station. There was an Act of Parliament in Britain which said that every boat that comes into the British Isles, approaching the British Isles, would have to put ashore there, and somebody would inspect everybody on board. And if you showed any sign at all of being ill, of having a contagion or a fever, you know, you might just have acne, or you might just have rosacea, or you might just be red-cheeked, but it could be the cholera. If you showed any sign of that at all, you would be plucked off the boat and stuck on St. Helens until you recovered. Well, of course, you wouldn't recover, because there was already a guy there that had got cholera, right. And you were going to catch it. And all around this rather sad building, which I also quite like, being a dark-spirited person, there are the graves of... There's an African buried there who'd come, you know, a vast distance to England to arrive on the Isles of Scilly. There's an East Asian skeleton there. There are many European skeletons. There's a skeleton of a 24-year-old lieutenant surgeon in the Navy who volunteered out of his good nature to try and cure the people there, give them medical help, but got typhoid and died. And so anyone, a writer particularly, but anybody who hears that story and sees that place was bound to be alerted, because it's one of the great stories. It's a story of hopes dashed. You know, people have come all of that distance. They've traveled those rough seas. They can see the cliffs of Cornwall just far in the distance. They're almost made dry land. Right. And the promised land of the United Kingdom, as I'm sure you'll know, it's such a wonderful place. And their hopes are dashed. And literature loves hopes dashed. Literature always seems to cluster around, you know, bad marriages rather than good ones, ill health rather than good health,
right.
Hopes dashed rather than hopes realized. And the reason it does that is because it enables us to visit difficult experiences before we encounter them. It enables us to prepare ourselves for the bad things that the universe has in wait for us.
Right.
So there it was, a subject matter for a book and a title for a book, because the building is called The Pest House. So that was the very first genesis of it. Then I had to wait for it to fill out and a subject matter to offer itself with. To it. I've got a picture here. You see, looking at you lot this afternoon, it looks like Saturday afternoon at the movies. Especially wet day. So the people in the cheap seats at the back won't be able to see this picture, but mind you, not all the people in the cheap seats, the expensive seats at the front. But in fact, this is a useless exercise completely. But there... In the tiny centre there is a picture of the pest house. It's okay, I've blown it up for you people at the back, although I don't really understand computers. There we are. But a little brick building on the Isles of Scilly was the starting point for this book.
So you talked about, a moment ago, various agendas sort of bubbling up over the years as you're thinking about a book.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if America's role in the world presently or recently is part of that agenda in writing The Pest House.
Yeah. Well, it came... Okay, can I give you a long answer?
Yes.
All right. Just as well. The next thing that came before America came into the scene was an interest I had in our reliance on technology and on everything that has come out of the Industrial Revolution. And my feeling that it's increasingly growing and a subject which virtually all of my books addressed is the way in which humankind has become separated, the works of humankind have become separated from the works of nature. So that if there were something to go wrong with our world, and we were the victims of some catastrophe, of which we've got so many to choose from at the moment, then the people who would be less able to cope with those things would be those people from the Western developed world who no longer know how to grow things even. They certainly don't know how to hunt and gather. They don't know how to make fire except with cigarette lighters. And so this was something of great interest to me, and I'd been thinking about how our world would look like if somebody in a time machine could have come from the 13th century and look at our world, someone with a medieval set of mindset. And we tend to think that we have created a world that is sort of beyond nature. You know, look at this thing here that's doing this job right now. You try and fit that into our sense of what nature, the natural world, provides for us. It's all there is in this world is the natural world, and yet this seems to be beyond nature, this thing here, and these glasses and you know, the chairs we're sitting on and the watch round your wrist and the computer in your pocket. They do seem to be beyond nature. And this has fascinated me because it seems to be something to glorify, but also a cause of great concern that we have developed into a society that has gone beyond nature. I've got something in my pocket to illustrate it. You see, like a school kid. Look at that, a simple... Can you see that? It's a simple nut and bolt. And you imagine if you arrived in a time machine from the 12th or the 13th century and you found something of that kind. You could, this is technology at its simplest. It's just a fence bolt. It's beautiful. It glisters. It does its job 100%. It's immensely strong. The way in which the bolt goes round on the thread at the bottom is unparalleled. It can't seem to be a work. Go on.
Is there any particular reason why you're carrying it?
You're gonna find out in a minute. Why I'm carrying it in my pocket?
Yes.
You've not got one in your pocket?
No.
Yes, well, they've all got one in their pocket. You would think, my, what a society that is. How jealous we are of a society that can produce works of that kind, works beyond nature. But... this nature does have a say. You wonder why I was wearing baggy trousers when I came. This is exactly the same thing 40 years down the line. And now we've lost the shine. It's put this under any pressure. It's already flaking. It's flaking in my pocket. It's degraded. You can't see the thread on it. The nut at the top does not move. And so... this is, in a way, when I found this on a walk, it just was sticking out of the ground and it looked like a piece of stick. If you see that and you come from a medieval time, you would think, I don't feel jealous of the age of metal at all, because that isn't functional, it wouldn't hold anything for very long, it doesn't compare in beauty to the wonderful wood screws that we can make out of cedar and ash and oak and such like. And so I was fascinated by this. I was fascinated by the way in which a medieval world would want to look at an advanced world. The next stage of that, finally we get, is where would I then set that book? The third ingredient, I'm going on rather long, do you want to...
Keep going.
Yeah. So the third and the major ingredient, and the ingredient I'm rather trying to put off discussing with you really, because I am in America now, and I don't wish to seem indelicate and upset anybody, but I'm genuinely feel awkward about this, but when it came to thinking about the book, there was a big issue coming up in the back of my mind, an issue that I wanted to resolve. And it was an issue that I think virtually everybody in the world wants to resolve, and it was about my relationship with the United States of America. And of course, nobody in this room or anywhere should be surprised that debate is going on. Because if you wanted to tell it just as a success story, the success story of America is that there is virtually nowhere in the world that American culture and hasn't touched, and American products haven't touched. There's a thing that Amazon are running at the moment, an Amazon short, which I talk about this, but I'll repeat some of it. Just last year, I went to the remotest village in Cambodia. To get there, I had to walk for 2 hours through a minefield. There was no roads there, there was no electricity, there was no sewage, there was no education, there was no medicine for the dysentery and the AIDS and the malaria that was there. But as I walked into the village, the first person I saw running towards me was a little kid with no trousers but a Nike t-shirt. And then once I'd got within the village, there were Coca-Cola cans. And then I heard a great sound booming out, and there was a television, a battery-operated television, operated by a car battery, and it was playing an old episode of The High Chaparral. Do you remember that? Only the older people in the audience remember it, but it was a black and white.
I remember.
You remember it, do you? Yeah. And there are many examples of this kind of thing. I go to my local cinema just last week with my wife, and there are 14 films showing, of which 12 are made in America. I'm in a hotel room anywhere in the world, and CNN is on. So the American success story is one which is undeniable, but it's one which enables and gives almost people anywhere in the world the right to have a view of America in the way that they're not going to have a view of Ecuador or Fiji or Finland. So this interested me, the fact that when I'm outside of America is nevertheless always with me the whole time. And that my reaction to this is, even though one admires America for all of its success, one is bound to feel ambiguous about it because of the sense that maybe the world is getting homogenized and that the world is getting homogenized in an American shape. So I was interested in that. And I knew that there was a lot of hostility. As you know, there's a lot of hostility about the Americanization of the world. And yet when I'm in America, as I am now, I'm totally in love with it. I love the wilderness, I love the hospitality, I love the fact that hope and opportunity are just stitched into the fabric of this country. So I'm not just trying to schmooze you. But that is what I feel. You add to that this weird confusion that then came about after 9/11, when everyone in the UK, I promise you, felt just like we were your bruised cousins, is what we felt like on that day. And we still feel like that when we think about events of 9/11. But all that is complicated by my unease and many people's unease about American foreign policy. So there's a whole debate going on, a legitimate debate going on, which is not fueled by any disrespect for America, but is inevitable, I think. You know, I hate it when people come to England and criticise us. You know, when people come, and Americans, I hear them in restaurants and saying, the Brits, they can't make coffee. I think, you know, love it or leave it is what I feel. And so I recognise this is an awkward debate to present to an American audience, but it is a debate that is going on throughout the world. For me, it's best summarised by this weirdness that just after the Iraq War started, there was a big public opinion poll in the Near East, in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, you know, several countries, big one. And question four was, which country in the world do you most despise? And you know what the answer is. 84% said the United States of America, you know, for political reasons. They were judging foreign policy. That's what they were doing. And then lower down, after about another 15 questions, there was another question. Which country in the world do you most want to emigrate to? 83%, you lost a percent, 83% wanted to come to the United States of America. And so this is telling us something very, very interesting, that that the American dream, the American opportunity, and I know that it's, you know, it's not always a dream realized, and I know that this is a country, like any country, full of terrible disparities, and I know that me as a white middle-aged male, I'm unlikely to encounter most of those things. But nevertheless, implicit in the results of that opinion poll is a debate of incredible interest that I wanted to resolve. And so this is what the book is about. This was me wanting to resolve my ambiguous feelings about the United States of America. So, in the sentence, I took the title from the Isles of Scilly.
That was all preface.
Right.
Here's the answer.
Yeah. I took the image of the pest house to stand for a diseased person and to stand for a diseased nation, right, and a diseased world. I roped in my interest of the relationship of the medieval and the non-industrial to the industrial and technological. And then I dumped it all on my interest in the American question. And the book has come up with an answer. And to find out what that answer is, you will have to pay $18.
It's a book filled with violence and disease and death and rape and near rape and a lot of dark happenings. And you've called yourself a dark writer. How do you feel when you're writing about such dark things happening?
Well, I call myself a dark writer almost to deflect the accusation of being one, because in my heart of hearts, I don't think I'm a dark writer. I think I'm an optimistic writer. But a lot of people, particularly in England, don't get my take on natural history and such like in the natural world. And that is because in squeamish Britain, and I don't know what it's like in squeamish Philadelphia, but it's extension of what I'm saying. We are separated. Humankind is separated from the natural world. We don't really take all of it in. We think that natural history in Britain, a lot too many people think that natural history is daffodils and rainbows and kingfishers. And of course it is, you know, those are the nice things to spot. But it's not true to think that natural history is like that. It's truer to say that this world comprises of compost. And now people think that that's a shabby, low, dark thing to say. It isn't. Go out tomorrow, test the truth of it. Just turn up a bit of turf with your foot and see that all the dead vegetation, which is what Earth is. Go along any beach and ask yourself what that shingle comprises of. Comprises of, you know, dead shells. See the kids filling their buckets with dead animals anyway without feeling morbid about it. So the world is made up of a small number of living things which then get recycled through putrefaction and through decay. Unless you take that on board, unless you recognize that for every kingfisher you see, there are 1,000 lice to be looked at. And for every daffodil you smell, there are mosses and less appealing weeds and such like. Let you take it all on board, then really you're not getting to grips about what is awesome about the universe. So I'm one of these natural historians that goes around, and if I see a dead seagull, I'm not going to back away with horror and think how disgusting, as if death is unacceptable. I will go over and I'll turn it over and I'll have a look at it because it is interesting. So I don't feel the kind of disgust that sometimes is attributed to me. When people attribute disgust about the natural world to me, actually it's their disgust that is being transferred to me because
I was actually thinking more horror or sadness than disgust.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much that's awful that happens as the pest house unfolds.
But that's books. And that's not a glib question, answer. That's books.
Yeah.
You know, if I were to turn up at my publishing house, as I could well do, next week, and they say, "What's your next book, Jim?" And I say, "It's going to be an autobiographical novel." Or what happens? Well, I'll tell you what happened in my life. I never heard my parents swear. They never smacked me once. I never heard them have an argument. We're a very happy household. You're going to buy this book? I've been married for 33 years. I've never had an affair. You don't want to read that book, do you? You know, that is not what literature does. Literature, it enjoys the exaggerated forms of right. things. It goes to the dark places. But the real test is what conclusion do you draw from those dark things, those visits to the wars, those scenes of rape, the illnesses that people encounter, the fear that people feel.
Right.
Feel. What is enduring at the end? What is the optimism that is shewn out of that? And you haven't mentioned those things. But,
no, I haven't.
But I don't know whether, well.
They're there.
They're there.
But it's a long trail. I mean,
yeah.
The question started with how the process of writing these scenes, because overwhelmingly it is scenes and adventures yeah. that are very dark.
Do you mean, do they make me feel low-spirited? While I'm doing it.
Yeah, as simple as that. That was the question.
Yeah. Yeah, I missed the simplicity of the question. But still, I wanted to say what I said anyway, so.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah. No, it's an odd business. It's a very self-serving business, writing. You're at home, on your own. No one's calling. The neighbours avoid you. It's a long day. And you're in a sort of a strange pod. It's all you can concentrate on is the task in front of you, and it seems almost as if it seems almost like an amoral activity to me sometimes. You know, you're writing about dreadful things, and yet you're not feeling grubby yourself.
So the specificity of what's happening and making it real and work is stronger
yes.
than
yes.
you know, that it's dark or awful.
Yes.
Or,
and also narrative itself is very impish and mischievous.
Yeah.
And so even though the writer himself or herself might be a very straight person that away from the page doesn't have a dark side to their nature at all and wouldn't like to think about unpleasant things for 1 second, while you're writing, this is a different activity.
Right.
In the same way that you can have someone with a very blithe spirit who can nevertheless play the most somber music on the piano. We don't ask questions about that about musicians. It seems quite natural.
Right.
Or a very, very sane person that does mad abstract expressionist paintings. That doesn't seem so mystifying.
Or we talk about how those things, playing the piano in that way, or painting, is cathartic and getting out something.
Well, it may be cathartic. I'm not sure about that in my case, because if I have lived this life, which has so far been very fortunate and doesn't have many dark corners in it, maybe the only way that I'm going to encounter those dark things and test my own courage, for example,
right.
or question myself firmly and strongly, is by doing it through fiction. But it does feel like a blind activity. You know, people, when Salman Rushdie's book came out, the Satanic Verses, as I'm sure you remember, a lot of people said, boy, how did he do that? How could he make that mistake? Because he was a Muslim. He came from a Pakistani background. He must have known that if he took on the subject of Allah in that way and criticised Allah's family in the way that he did, that he was going to end up in deep trouble. But I understand it completely. You're not thinking when you're writing that you can even get to the end of the sentence, let alone that you're going to finish the book, let alone that someone's going to like it, let alone that someone's going to publish it, let alone that someone's going to issue a fatwa. You know, all of those things are so remote. You're just absolutely stitched into the moment, which is why I guess it feels amoral. But in the end, it doesn't draw any blood from anybody, which is the difference between
right.
writing a book which upsets people and issuing fatwas which kill people.
Right, very different things. What do you think the United States will be like in 50 years?
Well, this book is not a prediction of what the United States
no,
might be like.
It's clearly not that.
Don't read it and imagine that this is what I think.
And I don't
happen.
Mean to suggest it is, but it's
no.
just I'm just trying to draw out, probably unfairly, something a little
no.
nasty about America.
No. Well, first of all, we have to think what could go wrong, and there are all sorts of natural disasters that could affect any nation. The specific ones that could affect America are the increasingly likely one, this is just to cheer you up, because you're too close to the East Coast, of the volcano collapse in the Canary Isles, which would cause an absolutely huge tsunami. And you know about this, do you? No, Fox News doesn't tell you. There is the problem of global warming, which I'm very glad to see. You know, there's almost a Kyoto acceptance amongst your leaders now. Right. Global warming is going to make some changes. If I were to be pessimistic, and I'm not pessimistic, I think the greatest danger to big communities, big crowded communities like the United States and the UK as well, is pandemic, is contagion. Just recently in the United Kingdom, over Christmas, we had a case where at the Bernard Matthews turkey farm, bird flu was found, avian flu. And they did a test which said if the avian flu could cross species into humankind, and the levels of death were equal to the levels of death that happened in 1919 when there was avian flu in the UK, and I believe 19 million people died. If that same level of deaths, not 19 million, the extrapolated figure, the new figure was 19 million. If the same figure was presented to the British Isles with a population of 60 million, almost 20 million of those people would die. Now, if you think if that happened in the United States, a third of the people were to die, then the question is, with such a shock to the infrastructure, could the infrastructure survive? So we're bound to be thinking about those things, because every day that you read the newspapers, there's a new scenario that is presented to you. That's why Cormac McCarthy has written a book on similar subjects. That's why there will be many more books on these subjects, because this is the 21st century subject. The dystopias of the 20th century were political dystopias, you know, 1984 and Brave New World. But the dystopias of the 21st centuries are all about the ends of the earth being destroyed by humankind. So in a worst-case scenario, something really bad can happen to the United States or anywhere in the world. But actually, I am not of a pessimistic bent. And I don't think humankind is really of a pessimistic bent. If you think about the major fact about everything that every one of us in this room has got in common, and this is not intended to depress you, but the one thing we've all got in common is, as sure as eggs is eggs, we are all going to die. That is the absolute certainty, the unavoidable certainty. At the end of this, we're dead, and it's over forever, except the word ever doesn't mean anything in that context. But here, why are we not all curled up like fetuses, screaming and whining? Because we have consciousness. We are the only creatures in the universe with such a high consciousness that we understand the import of the inevitability of our deaths. And yet we live our lives quite happily. I look at your faces, you all seem quite content. We skip around. Even as I describe it to you, I'm not in the least upset. And so I think humankind is a very well-managed, emotionally well, largely anyway, an emotionally well-managed creature. And that we, even though we are presented with all sorts of examples of things that can go wrong, certainly in our own lives, and things that can go wrong in our nation's lives, we don't in our heart of hearts really believe them. And it's in that that our optimism resides. And it's in that that my optimism resides as well.
I have one more question, then we'll go to our raffle. You said that you're not an outline flowchart sort of writer, that you kind of fly by the seat of your pants. Is that how you wrote The Pest House? That is, you didn't know what was coming next, have a view of the end or even, you know, even a next chapter maybe?
No, I had no idea. I got the impulses, the subject matter. But you can't write a book about a subject matter. You can't write a novel with a subject matter. It would just be a leaflet, wouldn't it? You know, you don't want to read leaflets. You have to allow the book to breathe and have a narrative. If I had an intention at the beginning of the book, it was that America would be put at the bottom of the pile instead of the top of the pile. It would defer to the rest of the world instead of, as now, the rest of the world deferring to it. Because I thought that would be interesting and mischievous. That small ocean that the Atlantic's become, so small that you can whip planes across to Afghanistan in 18 hours to drop bombs, would become big again. Because, you know, it's only recently that America's even been able to have a foreign policy. Because that the Atlantic used to be so wide, you know, you couldn't deliver foreign policy that quickly. So that was the idea, that I would upturn the westward bent trajectory of American history and send it eastbound to the East Coast, where people were fleeing America to find a future in Europe. What I didn't allow for, and this is why flying by the seats of your pants, as you describe it, is important, what I didn't allow for is that standing at my shoulder, nagging at me, was several hundred years of American narrative that had pre-existed me. And virtually all of those narratives are westward bound. You just think of everything from the Lewis and Clark, is it? Mm-hmm. The Lewis and Clark expeditions, to the Oregon Trail, the Grapes of Wrath. Those books go westwards in order to find new territory, in order to find the job. Thelma and Louise, they go westward in order to get away from the police, in order to find freedom. So many wagon trail stories go westwards to find that acre of land and a place where a family can be bring their kids up in a safe society. Even Borat went westward to have a date with Pamela Anderson. So, you know, not all of these things that you go in search for are going to be delivered. But when you're writing a book that hasn't got a fixed agenda, then such things start nagging at you. So pretty soon I realized there was a tussle going on in this book. There was a tussle between my political self that wanted to send America back to Europe, or where, you know, wherever it came from, back to where it came from. And there was the weight of American history and narrative which was saying, go west, go west. And it shouldn't surprise you that in the end, the West won.
Right.
And what we have at the end of the book, and this is the thing that you didn't mention when we were talking about the dark things in my book.
Right.
At the end, what we have is maybe the only things that do endure if you're looking for optimism at a time of dystopia. And this will sound cheesy, but it only sounds cheesy because it's familiar, and it's only familiar because it's true. What does endure at the end of this book is love and children and family and the hope of a better future. And that is what the book delivers at the end, I hope.
Yeah.
So you don't have to buy it now.
And in fairness, because I did kind of harp on the dark thing,
there
is throughout the book, really, a tender and lovely relationship between a man and a woman that develops in it.
And that's what happens, you know.
In a surprising and real way.
If you're playing it by the seat of your pants and you've got a character, you don't know what's going to happen, then you can relate to them yourself. I mean, one of the things you're doing, or I'm doing anyway, is falling in love with my own characters.
Right.
Even though the women in my books aren't very Hollywood-type women, I'm always a bit in love with the women in my books. I like strong, gutsy, adventurous, high-spirited women rather than necessarily beautiful women. And most of my female characters aren't all that beautiful, but they are strong. And Margaret, at the end of by the time I'd reached the end of this book, I was in love with Margaret.
Right.
And so that's an indulgence that you can have when you're sitting alone.
I was as well, because
you were as well.
I like strong women.
You leave her alone.
And redheads.
Yeah.
Let's turn to our raffle. I'm still hoping to get some questions for you guys. I think we're fighting time a little bit here, are we?
Is there someone with a question there? Oh, okay.
Okay, well, you'll be first, but go ahead and you're going to set up the raffle.
Okay, I'll do it quick. It's a very bizarre thing. Okay, you know what the book's about. When I proposed the idea of the book, I hadn't quite got the title yet. I hadn't made the connection between all those things I was telling you. That came later. I first decided I was going to write a book about America, and those other things that I mentioned fell in place in the way that I've described. But I wanted a contract for this book about America's medieval future. Because I wanted to be paid up front, of course, I'm not stupid. And so I contacted my publisher and they issued a contract and they said, well, what will we call, what should we put on the contract? What's the book called? I said, I don't know what it's called. And I said, but the first line of this book is, this used to be America. Actually, it turned out to be the last line of the first chapter. This used to be America. They said, okay, we issue a contract in that name. But whoever I was speaking to was an idiot. Or maybe my, you know, I wasn't speaking properly that day. Because a couple of days later, the contract arrived, and it was for a book called Useless America. And so I thought, oh, Useless America, oh no, that's not going to sell in Philadelphia. So
it might sell very well in Philadelphia.
Might it, yeah, yeah. Well, on election day, yeah. So I sent it back and said, this is wrong, issue another one. So for 2 days, this false manuscript existed. Now, you would have thought, we're going back now 3 years. You would have thought that that would have been the end of the matter. But in that 2 days, somebody had typed it into a computer. And computers have got lives of their own. Computers are beyond nature. And this computer had got a mate. And it called its mate, which was the computer at amazon.co.uk. And amazon.co.uk said, Useless America, I like the sound of that. I won't forget that. So it stored it away and it went buzz, 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 buzz for 3 years. And last September, bing, on my computer, a message from amazon.co.uk. Hi, Mr. Grace. As someone that has shown an interest in the books of Jim Crace before, you might like to know that his new novel, Useless America, is available in September, published by Penguin, 242 pages. It gave a cost. It had an ISBN number, you know, which is the catalogue number. It gave details of how much, when the paperback would come out and how much the paperback would be. And it was and everybody that had bought my books before got the same thing. I ordered 8 copies. The ranking on Amazon went up from 125,000 to about 6,000 just because I had ordered 8. So, you know, it's quite easy to become a bestseller. And I thought, well, this was the end of it. This is just a joke. Nothing will happen. Then the reviews started appearing. And I happen to have some here. I've got 5 stars with this book. So Michael S. Rose gives me 5 stars. And just to give you a sentence, he says, Crace is at his absolute best in Useless America. Mr. P.H. Turner from, doesn't say where he's from. Anyway, he gave me 5 stars as well. He said, this book is certainly a quick read. you know, they're full quotes. The one I like best is a man called Mark Whittaker from Manchester, UK. And his headliner was Unputdownable. And then his first sentence said, in fact, not just that, it's unpickupable. Jim Crace hasn't written a better book. Well, so this went round and it became kind of quite famous, and people were thinking, well, this is the perfect book for the future. It's a book that you can have an opinion on, but you don't have to read. Perfect. My publisher in America decided that this also was the future of publishing and decided that they would print 70 only copies of this book. And now this book, Useless America, is already worth, I believe, I've had an offer of $1,000 for a signed book, because book collectors love this kind of stuff, and there are only 70 in existence. It's got false epigraphs on the back. It's got a nice cover. It's got page numbers. It's got headings. It's got a little introduction. And it's got 240 blank pages. Now, this valuable, my most valuable work, my most critically well-received work, is going to be given to somebody here tonight, and I will sign it for them. How do we give it to them? Okay. Number 3. There you go. There's a pleased person. So, fine. So, if you see me afterwards, well done. So, now you're a rich man. The thing is, put it on eBay quick. Okay.
Let's go to questions. You had a question back in the center.
Oh, sorry. I mixed up the order. As a historian myself, I've actually written a lot about darker subject matter. I've referred to it in my undergraduate classes. And I was just wondering, as an natural historian, what's some of the more morbid things that you've enjoyed looking at, reading about, researching?
Well,
more on the morbid thing.
Well, yeah. I was in the Peak District walking a fortnight ago, and there was a... I don't know. The truthful answer is I've just been looking at cow turds. Because the fly population of cow turds, yeah, I'm embarrassed to answer this question, but the fly population of cow turds is very interesting. And they're specialists, you know, in a good Darwinist tradition. And there's been some changes in colour as well. We don't want to go into too many details, but all of that is interesting. You know, don't go through, you can't walk through the countryside and miss so many things because your mind is closed. There are beautiful smells around. Tear a bit of bark off a tree next time you're around, and an unimportant tree, please, and just smell it. And it smells musty at first and not too nice at first, but when you get used to the smell of bark, it's very, very beautiful. I was thinking just yesterday when I was in New York, and I saw a Jackson Pollock, and everyone's always talking about Jackson Pollock as sort of being abstract expressionism, as if that was beyond nature. And I was looking at this Jackson Pollock in the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and trying to work out what it was that it reminded me of. And then I had it. It was identical in pattern to the pattern that's on the inside of a crab shell, of a particular kind of crab, a compass crab they're called in the UK. Exactly the same as a crab shell. And virtually all these works of abstract expressionism, if you look at them close enough, have their counterparts in nature.
Hmm. Go ahead.
How do you approach your novels differently from your short stories? Because it seems as if you like very, very short, contained short stories, and then you also have these, you know, very large, sort of sprawling novels, especially set in Eastern history. So, you know, how is your own personal approach different? You described your process in terms of novels, but then how do you approach a short story?
Well, really, I've not. I know that they're sometimes described as collections of short stories, but The Devil's Larder and Continent, neither of them are really collections of short stories. They're really novels in part form, because they observe a lot of the unities. The Devil's Larder has got 64 stories in it, but all of the stories are about food, so they observe a unity of subject matter. They're all written in the same style. They have a unity of tone, set in the same place, unity of setting. They just don't share characters very much. So that book was conceived as a book about our social relationships with food and what food tells us about humankind and family and such like. But nevertheless, it's a different task. You know, when you're sitting down at a desk and you're just starting a work of fiction, and you know you've got 90,000 words ahead of you, that is scary. And it doesn't get any less scary, to tell you the truth. And you have to be quite, I don't want to make myself out to be, you know, it's not especially courageous, but you've got to be a bit determined to force your way into it. It feels as if it's a mountain that can never be crossed. And that's why writing something like The Devil's Larder or Continent, which are shorter pieces, was a joy. Because I say, well, I want to write this little piece, and I only want 300 words. And therefore, I think the answer to your question is that I have more fun writing those short pieces, and therefore those short pieces are more fun to read. So the most clearly humorous things I've written have been the short pieces.
And how much time did you spend writing The Pest House?
You spend a lot of time with it in gestation.
Right.
And then... I spend about 18 months prevaricating, lying to people. And what that amounts to is your editor phones up and it says, how's it going? And you say, oh, you know, I've done 70 pages and you haven't done anything. And it involves things like sitting in the garden in the deck chair when I hear my wife come back into the drive and I whip out get the deck chair away, get the tea away, I'm back in my room and she comes in the front door just in time and say, oh, I've had a terrible day. But it's inevitable. You shouldn't feel bad about that. Prevarication is actually part of the deal. Because during those months of prevarication, you're spotting what could go wrong with the book. You're seeing, you know, if you rush into a book too quickly, you make all of those early mistakes. Then I get down to it. Then people bully me. Then I start to feel more guilty than lazy. And at that time, it takes me about 6 or 7 months to write a complete book.
Yeah. You get cracking.
You get cracking. And then when you get into it, you know, it's like, when the moment of abandonment comes and it's really flying away on its own behalf, then you can't stay away from it. It's like a magnet. And that's joyful. That's a fine time.
Questions? Right here.
Do politics as a libertarian socialist isolate you from other UK writers today?
Yeah. Well, I live in Birmingham. I live in Birmingham, so I'm not part of that scene. I am... most British writers would claim to be progressives, but very few British writers are activists. British fiction has been damaged, I think, in the 19th century by someone like Shelley, who I admire greatly, said that writers are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. So this false view was put around that all you've got to do is to write some fine prose or a good poem, and that you will affect the agendas that people are thinking about and affect the thinking of men and women. And of course that's just pomposity and foolish. That's not the way to do things at all. If my only political action were to write books, then my books will have achieved nothing. My books are bourgeois, rhythmic, moralistic, metaphorical things. They don't address real issues. And when I see people reading my books, you know, they're just clones of me. I can tell you how they vote. I can tell you their relationship to red meat. You know, they're just like me. So it's a false thing to pretend that writing fiction, particularly literary fiction, is to engage in politics. So when I get involved in political activity, and I say to these people when I occasionally meet them, you should turn out, you should sign this petition, you should be there and be on this demonstration, you should take some action. Too many British writers reply, my politics are in my books, which I think is a really cowardly, pathetic thing to say. Actually, my politics are not in my books. Because if you let yourself be abandoned to whatever the narrative wants to do, then maybe the books don't represent truly your own politics. But I try and put my politics into my politics. So I'm still an old-fashioned activist. And I think that's possibly because I had a working-class background where political action was something that was admired, but wanting to be Walt Whitman wasn't.
Over here.
Right, later.
I have to take issue with your use of the word amoral when you were describing your process. I've only read one of your books, but I read it twice, and I'm about to go home and read it again tonight. And I felt that it's the couple that were murdered.
Being dead, yeah.
Being dead. Mm. Because I have a particular belief in the dark, I felt that it was one of the most moral books that I had ever read. And it never occurred to me that you were being morbid or that you even, I mean, I was curious, as anybody would be curious about you. But unless I misunderstand the word amoral, I certainly would not.
No, well, you're quite right to pick up on that, because when I used the word immoral, I knew that it wasn't quite the right word, but you know, I mean, it was a senior moment for me, I'm afraid. But what I meant was that maybe I meant blinkered. You know, when one is writing, one is blinkered to the task in hand. Well, I'm glad that you didn't find any disgust in that book, but that is a book which does divide a lot of people, and that's fine. I mean, you can't please everybody the whole time. And it's not personal, is what I always feel about it.
I think I actually have a copy of that book here.
Okay.
I like the ending, because to me it's like a eulogy for this couple. Yeah. And Joseph and Celise enjoy a loving and unconscious end beyond experience. These are the ever-ending days of being dead. That's totally the cadences of a religious service.
Mm. Yes.
Quarantine sounds like really something religious people.
One of the problems with modern atheism is that it's very often been formed from a political sense, a sense that if you reject God, you're rejecting the ruling class. And of course, I have a lot of sympathy with that. But it doesn't have much to offer at the clinch points of life, you know, when you're dying or when someone you love is dying. Where are the narratives of comfort from atheism to help you deal with those things? Religion has got narratives of comfort. They're false narratives, but the comfort isn't false. And so one of the things that I've been wanting to do in my writing is to give to atheism, to give to my concern and my admiration and my awe and love for the natural world, to give that a narrative which is also spiritual and which is also full of mysticism and it is also full of transcendence. The trouble is, you see, that even to say that, I have to use three words that belong to religion. Atheism doesn't even have the vocabulary to undertake that job. And so that is something that I try to do. Although I am entrenched in my atheism, I'm not evangelical about it. And I do regret the fact that the modern trends of atheism lack narrative, I guess.
We have time for one more question. Right here.
First of all, I want to thank you for all of your books. They've been wonderful.
Thank you.
Who do you read when you read books? Who are your favorite authors?
Well, I never want to send anybody home with a book list. And the worst I would do to you is to send you home with an empty book. I'm not a great reader anymore. And that is because I spend a lot of time in front of a screen writing. And it's also because I think that, certainly in my case, the books I fell in love with when I was younger and impressionable in my early 20s and my late teens were the enduring loves of my life where books are concerned. And even though I recognize that modern fiction and all kinds of modern writing are just as good as they ever were, if not better, I somehow have run out of an appetite for it. And so I don't read as much as I did. So the things I'm going to say to you, the books I'm going to say, are from the past. And my dear companion of a book is a book by Robert Louis Stevenson called Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes, which is a non-fiction book. You know those games you play? You could have a dinner with anybody from history. Who would you invite? You know, the Queen Mother or whatever. Richard Nixon, or, you know, that would be a great evening. I always choose R.L. Stevenson, Robert Louis Stevenson, because he was such an admirable, kindly spirited, widely experienced man. And it's so well expressed in this book, Travels with a Donkey. And of course, you do travel with him, and you are his travel companion. There's you and Robert Louis Stevenson and literature's best animal, Modestine the Donkey, who is such a sympathetic donkey. Not all donkeys are. So that's one book I would recommend. Very, very short, so I'm not giving you much reading. And I'm going to recommend another very short book, which is Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities. Which is just a huge leap of the imagination, inventing places to entertain, inventing cities that don't exist to entertain the Kubla Khan. Another very short book, which is wonderful. But these days, for pleasure, all I really read is natural history books, I'm sorry to say.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Jim is going to set up, what is it, Andy, upstairs? He's going to sign books and hang out. And he'll sign your empty book. But you're not allowed to sell it, right? Isn't that part of the deal?
Well, he can do what
but
he
it's,
wants.
But it's upstairs,
he
right?
He can write in it if he wants. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.